Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. I speak a lot about both personal actions you can take to improve the health of you and your loved ones and the many, many social and environmental conditions that profoundly impact our health. And today I'd like to talk a little bit about a case study in public health about obesity. When most people think about nutrition, particularly women, they think about calories. And in the last couple shows, I focused particularly on the highly processed diet and how that increases calorie intakes and weight gain, as well as a host of other health issues. So I'd like to talk about the obesity epidemic and use this recent obesity journal article entitled Three New Perspectives on the Perfect Storm: What's Behind the Obesity Epidemic. As most of the increase in obesity has occurred in the last 40 years, it's inappropriate to place the blame for the epidemic on genetics alone. Genetics probably loads the gun, while lifestyle in our obesogenic environment pulls the trigger for the spread of the obesity epidemic. By the way, obesogenic is just a fancy word for causing obesity. But talking about this whole genetics environment thing, we have to realize that human evolution, over 99.9% of human existence, getting enough calories has been a main thing for us to adapt to. So our bodies are adapted to trying to preserve and conserve and store energy. So our default actually is for putting on weight, which doesn't necessarily serve us well in the modern environment. Okay, back to the article. In an issue of Obesity, we asked three groups of investigators to provide us with their personal views, perspectives, on the respective roles of the food environment, the decrease in physical activity, and other environmental and/or behavioral factors in triggering the obesity epidemic. First, Hall reviews the potential roles of recent changes in dietary macronutrient content, protein, fat, and carbohydrate on weight gain. He concludes that the overall caloric content, rather than changes in a single macronutrient, is to blame for the overall population weight gain. More specifically, he hypothesizes that the changes in the quantity and quality of the food supply, in conjunction with a drastic increase in the consumption of highly processed, palatable, and cheap food with high amounts of sugar, fat, salt, and flavor additives have triggered overconsumption of calories. The traditional normative eating behaviors have progressively switched from time-consuming home meal cooking to more ubiquitous snacking and eating of large portion-sized meals, often ate at restaurants. In the second perspective, Church and Martin remind us that formal exercise, regular recreational exercise, has not changed over the past few decades, but occupational activity has. Indeed, by 2006, only 20% of American jobs required high levels of physical activity, thus representing a huge drop from the 1960s, when more than 50% of jobs required levels of physical activity that met the current daily physical activity goals. Interestingly, Church and Martin propose that the present low level of occupational activity has pushed most people into a zone of low energy expenditure in which intake becomes somewhat uncoupled to expenditure. Finally, in the third perspective, David, Plaisance, and Allison update the list of other environmental and behavioral factors that may have ramped up the prevalence of obesity beyond the role of the big two, that is, food environment and physical activity. They propose that poor sleep hygiene and decreased cigarette smoking can both push the energy balance towards a surplus of energy. Similarly, environmental factors such as increased atmospheric levels of CO2, living in thermal neutrality most of the year, spending countless hours in front of electronic screens, being exposed to chemicals known to disrupt endocrine functions, and increased consumption of medications can all tip the energy balance equation in an unhealthy direction. Finally, they add to the list the potential role of an unhealthy microbiome and the undisputed role of socio-physiological factors such as economic disparity to the long list of weight gain drivers. In summary, the three perspectives come at the right time to remind us that human-engineered changes in environmental conditions have resulted in improved health, reduction in infectious disease, and extension of lifespan, but have also triggered an epidemic of non-communicable chronic diseases such as obesity and its comorbidities. These environmental changes have set up the perfect storm to create what has been called the obesogenic environment. In turn, this has caused a new epidemic of chronic diseases, which will eventually reverse most of the benefits of what research and novel medications have done to eradicate most of the infectious diseases. The challenge of upcoming decades will be to reverse some of these deleterious trends towards poor health. Can we learn from other epidemics? Too much malaria? Drain the swamps and eradicate the mosquitoes. Too many deaths on highways? Impose speed regulations and the use of seatbelts. Too many health problems related to obesity? Reverse some of the environmental changes that have triggered the rise in the prevalence of obesity. Where to start? Redesign our built environment to be more conducive to walking, biking, and grocery shopping. Encourage physical activity from the youngest age in the school system and within families. Incentivize the food industry in being part of the solution by producing and marketing novel, healthy food. Develop public health policies mandating changes in the food and environmental sectors to create better health. Create a safe environment with minimal amounts of pollutants. All these proactive steps could help in reversing the tide and solving the societal health problem. I wanted to use this case study of obesity because it's a really good example about how complex the causation of different disease epidemics. And I'd like to go back a little bit just to the whole genes versus environment argument. I've looked at this for many, many years, and it looks that rather reliably, the answer to that question is most things are about 30% genetic and about 70% environment. So a good 2-to-1 the environment. And when you're looking at nutrition studies, and you look at people that are migrating from one country to another, you find that the people that migrate adopt the disease profile of the new adopted country. And this can be profound changes in their health profiles. However, that doesn't mean that this environment is largely over our own personal control. Much of that environment is shared, of course, or you could call it inherited environment. And dealing with the shared or inherited environment calls, of course, for collective action. And this is the very nature of public health, looking at the health of populations, the whole society as a whole, rather than looking just as individuals as a medical approach would. And sticking to that theme, I want to do just one story from AP News. FDA sampling finds toxic nonstick compounds in some food. A good example of our shared environment and how things we have either we don't know of or have very little control over. The Food and Drug Administration found substantial levels of a worrisome class of nonstick stain-resistant industrial compounds in some grocery store meats and seafood and in off-the-shelf chocolate cake, according to FDA researchers. The levels in nearly half of the meat and fish tested were 2 or more times over the currently existing federal advisory level for any kind of the widely used man-made compounds, which are called per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS. I reported a lot on this. The level in the chocolate cake was higher, more than 250 times the only federal guidelines which are for some PFAS in drinking water. There are nearly 5,000 varieties of PFAS, which DuPont created in 1938 and first put into use for nonstick cookware. Industries use them in countless consumer items, food packaging, carpets and couches, dental floss, and outdoor gear to repel grease, water, and stains. The compounds have been dubbed forever chemicals because they take thousands of years to degrade and because some accumulate in people's bodies. The EPA has said it would consider setting mandatory limits instead after the toxicology report and after federally mandated PFAS testing of water systems found contamination. The administration, when being called out, called dealing with PFAS, quote, a potential public relations nightmare. Of course, they view it more as public relations than public health, but so that is also a part of the public health situation. And not to be totally depressing, I'd like to talk a little bit about what something we control, and this is something that took effect last year from the FDA.gov. Calories on the menu. Eating out and eating healthy just got easier. In today's busy world, Americans eat and drink about one-third of their calories from foods prepared away from home. In general, these foods provide more calories, sodium, and saturated fat than meals consumed at home. For the average adult, eating one meal away for home each week translates to roughly 2 extra pounds each year. Over the course of 5 years, that's 10 extra pounds. Calorie labeling on menus can help you make informed and healthful decisions about meals and snacks. Beginning May of 2018, calories must be listed on many menus and menu boards of restaurants and other food establishments that are part of a chain of 20 or more locations. This will help you know your options and make it easier to eat healthy when eating out. You may have noticed calorie information on some menus or menu boards, or maybe you have seen nutrition information on restaurant websites or on phone apps. This information can help you make informed and healthful meal and snack choices. Calories are listed next to the name or price of the food or beverages on menus and menu boards, including drive-through windows, and maybe at the following types of chains: chain restaurants, chain coffee shops, bakeries, ice cream shops, self-service food locations such as buffets and salad bars, movie theaters, amusement parks, grocery and convenience stores. When a menu item is available in different flavors or varieties, for example, vanilla and chocolate ice cream, or includes an entree with your choice of side items, such as a sandwich that comes with either chips, side salad, or fruit, the calorie amounts will be shown as follows. If there are two choices, the calories are separated by a slash or a dash. If three or more choices, calories are shown in a range, for example, 150 to 300 calories. In addition to calorie information, covered establishments are also required to provide written nutrition information such as saturated fat, sodium, and dietary fiber to consumers upon request. So when eating out, don't hesitate to ask for more nutrition information if you need it. When eating out, try these tips to help you make the best choices for you and your family. Side dishes can add many calories to a meal. Steamed, grilled, or broiled vegetables and fruit are often lower calorie options. Calorie information can help you decide how much to enjoy now and how much to save for later. Asking for sauces or salad dressings on the side lets you choose how much to use. Foods described with words like creamy, fried, breaded, battered, or buttered are typically higher in calories than foods described as baked, roasted, steamed, grilled, or broiled. Calories from beverages can add up quickly. With calorie information, you can find lower calorie options. Okay, now to the public health news and research roundup, where I scan public health information so you don't have to.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research Roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
First up, how Monsanto manipulates journals and academics from The Guardian. Over the past year, evidence of Monsanto's deceptive efforts to defend the safety of its top-selling Roundup herbicide have been laid bare for all to see. Through three civil trials, the public release of internal corporate communications has revealed conduct that all three juries have found so unethical as to warrant punishing punitive damage awards. Much attention has been paid to Monsanto conversations in which company scientists casually discuss ghostwriting scientific papers and suppressing science that conflicts with corporate assertions of Roundup safety. There has also been public outrage over internal records illustrating cozy relationships with friendly regulators which border on and possibly cross into collusion. But these once confidential Monsanto documents demonstrate that the deception has gone much deeper. In addition to the manipulation of science and of regulators, the company's most insidious deceit may be its strategic manipulation of the media. Lawyer Tim Litzenberg, who represents several plaintiffs suing Monsanto over claims Roundup causes cancer, told me that he has traced what he calls, quote, a dark money project by Monsanto aimed at winning favorable public opinion. The project includes planting helpful news articles in traditional news outlets, discrediting and harassing journalists who refuse to parrot the company's propaganda, and secretly funding front groups to amplify pro-Monsanto messaging across social media platforms. Okay, well, I'd like to highlight a couple articles that have to deal with racism and racial disparity. This one from Science Daily. Study may explain how racial discrimination raises the risk of disease among African Americans. A new study indicates that racism is toxic to humans. Surprise, surprise. A team of USC and UCLA scientists found that racist experiences appear to increase inflammation in African-American individuals, raising their risk of chronic illness. We know discrimination is linked to health outcomes, but no one was sure exactly how it harmed health. Our results show that racial discrimination appears to trigger an inflammatory response among African-Americans at the cellular level. Inflammation serves to protect an organism from a health threat, but if someone feels under threat for long periods of time, their health may suffer significantly from chronic inflammation. The scientists made sure that all the participants had similar socioeconomic background to account for financial stressors, which eliminated poverty as a potential factor for chronic inflammation among the people in the study. Racial discrimination is a different type of chronic stressor than poverty. People navigate poverty on a day-to-day basis and are aware that it is happening. They might even be able to address financial stressors through job changes, changes in earnings, and financial management. But with discrimination, you don't always realize what's happening. Individual decisions or lifestyles can reduce the ill effects of some stressors, but racial discrimination is a chronic stressor that people have no control over. You can't change your skin color. And from JS Online, Milwaukee County Executive signs resolution declaring racism a public health crisis. Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abelli signed a resolution declaring racism a public health crisis, saying this was about action. Everybody has been reading and hearing about the same set of statistics in Milwaukee for decades. We lead in an unfortunate way the racial disparities in employment, in education, incarceration, income, and even things like access to capital. The resolution is about making a public commitment to take action. Every decision across the county should be framed in terms of how to make a difference in these disparities. Racism is deep-rooted and linked to negative health outcomes. Locally, that includes its impacts on students of color, inequitable practices in government, high death rates and infant mortality, lack of prenatal care, and housing segregation. The county resolves to assess internal policies and procedures to make sure racial equity is a core element of the county. Work to create an inclusive organization and identify specific activities to increase diversity. Incorporate inclusion and equity and offer educational training to expand employees' understanding of how racism affects people. Advocate for policies that improve health in communities of color. Encourage other local, state, and national entities to recognize racism as a public health crisis. For instance, as reporting on this show, your local activist radio, 106.1 FM. Now, sticking to a similar thing, This is an article from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, where mental health and social justice meet. And this is regarding a leader committed to the mental health and healing of Black communities, sharing his insights. And I'll read most of this interview, which is rather long, but I think very worthy. Okay. A few years ago, I read a painfully insightful account of the New York Times of what it means to be a Black American struggling with mental health. The author vividly describes how socio-historical trauma lives in our blood, materializing in our daily lives and ultimately affecting our mental health. A groundbreaking 2017 poll that the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation supported offers more insight into how discrimination fuels persistent stress. This stress leads to physiological responses that raise the risk of heart disease, stroke, and diabetes. Trauma and violence are also more likely to affect the lives of boys and young men of color, often leaving them with unresolved psychological wounds. Compounding these problems are the many barriers that prevent African Americans from receiving adequate mental health services. These include stigma and lack of representation among and trust of providers. An inspiring leader I recently met, Mr. Yolo Akila Robinson, is dedicated to addressing this very problem. Robinson received the 2018 Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Award for Health Equity, which honors leaders who are changing systems and showing how solutions at the community level can lead to health equity. He is the executive director of BEAM, which stands for Black Emotional and Mental Health Collective. BEAM trains healthcare providers and community activists to be sensitive to the issues that plague Black communities. BEAM has many programs that focus on men, boys, and non-gender conforming people. I was pleased to delve deeper into Robinson's work in the following Q&A. What led you to your work in mental health advocacy? I've been working in public health for the past 15 years, focusing on wellness, mental health, violence prevention, and HIV/AIDS. I saw huge pieces that were missing almost everywhere. I saw people who were visiting community-based organizations and hearing stigmatizing messages. For example, when I was working at an institution in Atlanta, a young man confided in an HIV testing counselor, "Sometimes I hear voices." The counsel response was unsettling. "Oh my God, that sounds really bad. That's crazy. You need to talk to somebody," he said. As a result, the young man grew fearful, shut down, and altogether avoided discussing what troubled him. Clearly, these kinds of messages and negative terminology are re-traumatizing and made him afraid to move forward and talking to a mental health worker and getting care. What are the top mistakes that people within organizations might make in serving Black clients, from receptionists to doctors, even though they're trying to help? It's important to think critically about how we subconsciously respond to Black people. For example, research suggests that medical students and residents may hold and use false beliefs about biological differences between Blacks and whites to inform medical judgment. This may contribute to disparities in how they assess and treat pain, leading them to make different decisions about treatment than they would for white patients. We all grow up internalizing things we hear, whether we like them or not. BEAM's approach to unconscious bias is that all of us grow up learning racism, sexism, and other isms. So for me, as someone raised and perceived as male, it would be impossible to not, in my 37 years of life, have learned biases toward women or have been taught behaviors that encourage me to dominate, silence, or diminish them. That's an unfortunate aspect of American culture. Instead of denying or pretending to be color or gender blind, we need honest exploration about the toxic things we learned, and this can help us unlearn them, along with ongoing assessment. For example, as a man, am I taking up too much space? How am I using my power to support women? How could I be engaging other men to stop a culture of violence against women? That work is ongoing, and that means I need to always be cognizant when I am engaging someone different, that I may embody privilege in relation to them. Can you mention a few of the unique barriers African Americans experiencing mental health problems encounter when seeking care? The biggest systemic level barriers that many Black people face are access and community. When I say access, I mean having health insurance and money for a copay, having transportation to get to and from services, especially in rural communities, and finding culturally competent, sensitive enrollment processes that take into consideration the burden and fear that engaging therapy will bring up for many in our community. Another barrier is the community. When our churches teach us that we can pray it all away, or our families believe that a whooping or discipline is the issue instead of legitimate psychological distress, they keep us from getting the care we need, and the intergenerational trauma continues. These issues, compounded with the structural barriers of ableism, transphobia, racism, homophobia, and black mental health myths, are considerable challenges. BEAM responds to these barriers in many ways. Our Black Mental Health and Healing Justice Training trains educators, activists, religious leaders, and many more who work in the Black communities on accurate mental health information, peer support skills, and strategies to dismantle mental health myths. Our training also holds space for the unique ways racism, transphobia, sexism, and homophobia impact mental health, something few other mental health literacy interventions in the country do. This intervention helps really address community-level barriers. For systemic-level barriers, we provide training and technical assistance to organizations to help them integrate healing justice, mental health, into their direct service and operations. Our Transforming Our Systems, Transforming Ourselves initiative also specifically supports organizations with assessing the wellness of their staff, as well as how they're impacting communities. I also have to mention our Southern Healing Support Fund, which offers microgrants to Black therapists, yoga teachers, and herbalists doing care support work in the rural Deep South. You also work with African American college-age men, helping them address rigid masculine norms that may contribute to poor mental health. What are these issues? The unique intersection of race and culture has led to what we now call Black masculinity. This is, among other things, the idea that Black men should embrace hardness, which is emotionally harmful and counterintuitive to our well-being. This notion of masculinity is perpetuated across racial and ethnic categories. However, because of the economic disadvantages for Black men, there is pressure to perform in ways that are debatably more rigid than for white men. Though through our efforts around masculinity and mental health training, we work with people who identify as men, asking them, how did you learn about masculinity? And how did that influence your relationship to your emotional or mental health? How are the women in your life impacted because of being in a relationship with a person who doesn't want to commit to their well-being? How does that create loneliness, violence, isolation, misogyny, and transphobia? Our program also involves a community project, so people can bring lessons into churches, fraternities, and schools. It's not just the 20 or 30 folks in the room hearing these conversations. That dialogue is going to your dad and your uncle. We're hoping this leads to further learning and empowers young people who come to believe, I can interrupt violence when I see my friend or my boy being disruptive, and that doesn't make me less of a man. We have a lot of unlearning to do, but we can be different kinds of men and people. We can create a world that centers on healing and doesn't create harm. You also focus on helping caretakers to look after themselves. Why? Many of us who are doing healing justice, mental health, or other support work in our communities are drawn to it because of our own trauma. We may be survivors of the very issues we are trying to address, such as assault or chronic illness. We develop an altruism that leads to us becoming self-sacrificial in our approach towards how we nurture others. We push ourselves aside, minimizing our own needs. Healing others actually becomes an avoidance mechanism. Also, people can say things that trigger and awaken our own anxiety, like when I talk to a man about how he beat his daughter. These aren't always amicable clinical interactions either. When you're facing and listening to so much distress, it lands in your heart. If I'm not paying attention to my own wellness and biases, that may become a barrier that shows up in interactions with those in my care. I could be more aggressive or short with someone, or I can burn out and become indifferent or so exhausted that I don't come to work. We need to recognize this and attend to wellness and make space for it. Some of my own self-care involves getting the basic essentials like sleeping, eating healthy foods, getting downtime, and going to therapy, which is honestly amazing. Having an hour to focus on my feelings and processing has meant everything. This is not something extra that you do after work. This is the work. Okay, I want to end today's show on some good news about racial disparities. This from Stat News. The Affordable Care Act erased a racial disparity in cancer care, a new study says. The expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act in 2010 nearly erased a key disparity in access to cancer care between white and African American patients. Without Medicaid expansion, white patients received chemotherapy within a month of their cancer diagnosis 48.3% of the time, but African American patients received chemotherapy within a month only 43.5% of the time, a 4.8% difference. In states where Medicaid has expanded, this 4.8% difference decreased to 0.8%, a non-statistically significant difference. In white patients, the Medicaid expansion increased the percent of patients who received chemotherapy in a month by 2 points. Among African Americans, there was a 6-point change. Two other studies related to the effect of insurance on care. One showed that women were diagnosed with ovarian cancer sooner after the ACA went into effect. Another study documented several ways that higher incomes and better insurance determine the outcomes of people with multiple myeloma, a blood cancer. Patients treated at academic medical centers had a 40% greater probability of survival. Those from areas with higher regional incomes had 16% greater chance of survival compared to those from lower income areas. And people with private insurance had a 59% greater chance of survival than those who were insured through Medicaid. Such things as Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act do make a difference. Well, that ends our show. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. You can listen to this show or any previous show by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Again, that's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice. Sweet.